Welcome back to A Hamster with a Blunt Penknife, the Doctor Who commentary podcast. I am still here, and still here, with the wonderful Joe Ford. And today, we are going to be talking about episode 3 of The Sea Devils. Are you looking forward to it, Joe?
I am. So is the fly that just came in the window there. You may hear buzzing around the room.
Yeah, indeed. It's a bit of a monster.
I believe this is the episode of The Sea Devils where we're introduced to the submarine.
It may well be. I can't remember, to be honest.
That goes to investigate. Now, Barry Letts says on many a commentary, when they had a six-parter, they always had to add a subplot or an extra element, like the plague in the Silurians.
Subplot. I see what you did there.
Thank you very much. Yeah, that was entirely accidental, I assure you. And it is true. And I think the stories that suffer is stuff like Monster of Peladon, where you effectively have, I suppose the Ice Warriors are the big extra in sort of episode 3 of that one. Yeah, and I don't think it's until we get to Hinchcliffe's time where the six parts are actually paced, something like Genesis of the Daleks, where it starts out very open and then gets more claustrophobic as the story goes along.
Once Hinchcliffe actually started stamping his thing on it, they started viewing six-parters as 4 plus 2, 4 2 plus 4. Like the Seeds of Doom has 2 episodes in the Antarctic. Then it moves.
It's a savvy move, isn't it?
Yes. Invasion of Time, 4 episodes of the Vardens and 2 episodes of the Sontarans. And even the talent of Wang Chiang to a point suddenly sort of switches direction after episode 4.
Even the Three Doctors, it goes to 3 different locations for each episode. So it sort of shifts each time. Yeah, yeah. You kind of have to do it, haven't you? Because, what is it? 2.5 hours? That's a long running time.
It is a long running time. And it's, and I've said this before, but I keep seeing people on Twitter complaining about it. And, these are so long and so boring. It's like, yeah, but you weren't supposed to watch them in one sitting. You were supposed to watch 25 minutes of television and be carried along. And the fact that it was still telling the same story 6 weeks later and coming to an end is beside the point, really. You're not supposed to sit there and watch from episode 1 to episode 6 all in one sitting.
Under those circumstances, I think if you watch just 25 minutes a week, that must feel like it goes by in a heartbeat. Watching it live at the time.
Yeah, it must have. I mean, I remember watching the repeats and thinking, I've got to wait a week to find out what happens next. That's,
Well, guess what? You haven't got to wait a week this time, baby. We're going straight into episode 3.
Let's go to episode 3. Count us in, Joe.
I made you count 1 and 2, didn't I?
You did, you count us in.
Well, I'll do 3 and 4 then.
You do that.
I'm not scared to pull my weight. In 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Off we go. Now, back to the whip pan. Okay, I don't know what's happened there.
Okay. Weird things going on with the Blu-ray player here.
Okay, keep talking.
I'll keep talking. So we were trying to watch episode 3 of The Sea Devils, but
suddenly we have a message coming up that says copyright violation.
Yeah, all we want to do is play it.
I assure you, I own this Blu-ray. I paid good money for it.
I can see the box set and everything. It's all legit and above board.
Okay, hang on a second. In 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Off we go. Second time lucky, because we just had a copyright violation message.
Yeah.
And I assure you, it's not a bootleg Blu-ray set. No. Well, you can buy those vanilla ones now, can't you? That doesn't have the artwork. The sort of cheaper ones.
Yeah.
You look confused then, as if there was a criminal market for Doctor Who Blu-rays.
That may well be.
I'll put you in touch with the right person, all right?
I get the special edition box sets, I pre-order them, I get them all sent through.
Can I ask you, they did that documentary, Sex, Lies and Videotapes, when people were, doing illicit deals with people copying VHSs of Doctor Who back in the day. Did you have a supplier?
No, but I did have a couple of bootleg copies.
Acquired
at a comic fair, actually, the comic exhibition in Hove. and Colin Baker was the guest, I remember. And I remember it distinctly because I may have mentioned this on a previous podcast. The guest panel took place in Hove Town Hall in the council chambers, which was basically a room with a raised desk at the front and semicircular desks with microphones and desk lamps and things. So it kind of looked like an official, like, UN meeting or something.
Wow.
And we were all sat round talking to Colin Baker. And Michael Jayston turned up unexpectedly.
Oh, you have told me this, yes.
So I think I have mentioned that before. But in
what's that
the,
got to do with your bootleg copies?
Well, in the dealer's area was somebody who had bootleg copies of orphaned...
selling them at an event.
Orphaned episodes and audio cassettes of missing episodes. And I acquired... They were not expensive. But I acquired a VHS of The Reign of Terror, parts 1, 2, 3 and 6. And The Tenth Planet, 1 to 3.
Wow.
And an audio cassette with Mission to the Unknown and The Tenth Planet, part 4.
And are The Tenth Planet and The Reign of Terror two of your favourites?
No.
Yeah. It's a good thing they weren't expensive then, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I enjoyed, because obviously they were new Doctor Who for me then, you know, but they were duff quality, fuzzy, you know, you couldn't see that the Cybermen's head were held together with sellotape in my VHS copy of The Tenth Planet.
Oh, I've had that conversation with people, you know, especially about the Mind Robber and that Cyberama.
You may have mentioned that once or twice.
Once or 10 times, yeah. but it is true. Sometimes the more you clean something up, the less...
Oh, yeah.
Visually impressive it looks.
Oh yeah, I mean,
weirdly enough,
I've seen people pointing out things like in the Next Generation, the Star Trek: The Next Generation Blu-ray remastered, and now you can see the wood grain.
Those
on the
sets
desk
look terrible,
and the cardboard
now. Yeah,
and things like that.
It's very unfortunate, and you can see in crystal clear, you know, Beverly Crusher's overdone blusher.
Yeah,
and things
this is
like
the thing.
This.
They weren't supposed to be seen with that degree of clarity.
I think this is the first time, you know, Trenchard really thinks, what have I got involved in here? Because the Master genuinely did try and kill the Doctor then.
Yes. Very definitely.
That's what works about the cliffhanger for me. Not so much as, I know you're right, we're never going to have a knife thudding into the Doctor's back and that's going to be the end of him. But the Master is genuinely trying to kill him.
Yeah, and it is a significant point in the plot, as you say, with Trenchard realising that actually something is going on. But the Master manages to talk him round again.
What's fabulous now is Pertwee can just drop all the pretense, yeah, and just basically be like, oh, Trenchard, you fool, you know?
Yes.
What's up with this god? Oh, he's been hypnotised, hasn't he? Can I ask you about the crimes against moustaches in the 70s?
The facial hair on the guards in this story is almost a character in its own right, isn't
not
it?
Not as bad as Colony in Space. The moustache budget for that story was through the roof.
Yes.
Yeah, see, we do this again, don't we? We've got Trenchard basically building a case against the Doctor, but Hulk has great fun with that in Frontier in Space, doesn't he? When there's all those ridiculous crimes that the Doctor supposedly committed.
Yeah. This is kind of, I mean, I know people talk about Doctor Who being scary in terms of the monsters and the aliens and things like that. For me, a lot of the scary stuff in Doctor Who comes when the characters find themselves in situations where the officials are basically denying them the opportunity to get away or put their case or whatever. Like here, Trenchard is just, no, you can't make a phone call. I'm going to tear up your pass because I think it's a forgery. Because I'm in this position of power and authority and I can do this to you. And Frontier in Space is a classic example of that, because they're going to, you know, the Doctor is going to be sent to the Lunar Penal Colony. Joe's going to go to prison or whatever. Just because nobody is actually listening to them, and even to the point where General Williams puts the Doctor under the mind probe, which they say is the way of getting the truth, but because it doesn't give him the truth he wants,
yeah,
he still carries on and everything else. And for me, that's even more terrifying than finding yourself face-to-face with an alien.
It's
getting into a position.
It's not unrealistic, is it? Because we know there are people that have been caught up in the legal system unjustly.
Absolutely, we do. And that's, you know, that's scary because it's possible that you might encounter it yourself.
One of the reasons why I don't get very scared, and there's loads I admire about the John Pertwee era, and I think in terms of comfort Doctor Who, this is my era. This is what, when I get, I'm on a bad day, I'll come home and I'll put on a John Pertwee story. One of the reasons why it doesn't frighten me like some of the other eras is because he's so stalwart, and I'm always absolutely sure that John Pertwee will prevail from the first second. Whereas if I watch something like a Troughton story, where he allows himself to be frightened and scared, and I get a bit of anxiety. Like, as a child, I remember watching The Mind Robber and all that sort of, oh no, in the TARDIS at the beginning. I was like, oh, what's going on? It's in the TARDIS. The Doctor's scared, you know, like, I'm not safe.
And you do get the feeling sometimes with some of the other Doctors, you get the feeling that they win by luck rather than anything else, whereas with John Pertwee you definitely think he's in control, even when he's in a situation which looks bad. He seems so relaxed, and it's like, well, something will come along, I will be able to figure out, I'm just waiting for my opportunity to figure out a way to get out of this.
And it's something, actually, I don't often throw too many compliments towards the Peter Davison era, but he was allowed to be scared and anxious as well. And Davison played those moments really, really well.
Yeah.
There is one cliffhanger, you know, I know you loathe it. I think you gave it 1 out of 10 to. But I think it's a great moment because it shows the Doctor scared. Horror of Fang Rock, episode 3.
Oh, no. No. Terrible, terrible cliffhanger.
I've locked it in here. With us.
Terrible. Oh, no. Terrible, terrible cliffhanger.
Oh, did you see that? How very kind of you. How very unkind of you. Oh, now the master's wearing his proper...
He's back in his master gear now. All pretense has gone.
Black outfit.
Yeah.
Now, I cannot remember the fella's name, which is annoying, because he played Rassilon in Hellbent, and he played Erasmus Darkling in the Sarah Jane Adventures.
Donald Sumpter. Who is going to pop up here?
He is beautiful in this story.
Of the submarine, and had previously been Enrico Casali in The Wheel in Space.
Of course he was, yeah. Was he blacked up in that?
A little bit, yeah.
Yeah.
And putting on an accent. But as such, holds the record currently.
What, for most reappearances?
Not for most reappearances, but for the longest gap between first and most recent from a guest actor.
Okay.
William Russell, of course, shattered that in The Power of the Doctor. Yeah. But in terms of guest cast who aren't regulars, Donald Sumpter had 47 years between The Wheel in Space and Hellbent.
Well,
and I think Arthur Cox had had it up to that point with The Dominators 11th Hour.
Yeah.
But yeah, Donald Sumpter has now shattered that. And of course, William Russell has just... He's in the Guinness World Records now.
What, for having the...
For the longest gap between his last and most recent appearance as the same character in the same TV show. So it's obviously 57 years.
I just basically wanted to warn you that every time we go down into the submarine, I will be getting a little bit horny, because he does look beautiful in that naval uniform. Okay. I would not say that about Rassilon and Hellbent.
Thank you for the warning.
You're welcome. Oh, here comes the sub now.
Here comes the submarine now, yeah.
Is it going under? You have been in a submarine.
I have not been in a submarine.
I have been in a submarine. And I'm telling you now, it ain't as big as they make it appear in this.
No, that's one thing I do know
it's
about
submarines. It's fucking cramped, I tell you.
Well, apparently, have you ever heard... John Pertwee's one-man show that he did about the year before he died.
No, he does too many silly voices in those shows.
It's great. But he said when he joined the Navy, he was first assigned to submarines, and he was 6'2½".
Oh dear, he had to stoop a lot then.
He said he recounts that every time the commanding officer went Pertwee, he went sir, and he banged his head every time. And apparently, the way he tells it, he went round with a plaster on his head. And his commanding officer said, that wound is taking a long time to heal. He said, I haven't got one. I'm wearing this so I don't get one. So they got him transferred.
Another thing that Barry Letts often says on commentaries is how John Pertwee can embellish a tale for entertainment purposes.
He can, absolutely.
Do you know who that is? It's Hyacinth Bouquet's neighbour from Keeping Up Appearances.
Emmett. From Keeping Up Appearances. There's Donald Sumpter.
He hasn't changed a bit. Look at him. He looks exactly the same in the 90s. I believe their relationship, him and the first officer, this.
That is nicely done.
And I love the scenes as well. I think there might be all sort of padding going under the water and that. But I love the scenes where the crew are trying to retake the ship as well.
Mm.
And there's lots of sort of invisible signalling going on between them. They feel like an effective unit that work together.
Yeah.
Oh, and this is... And every time they do this, they put the Doctor at a disadvantage and the Master in control. I love it. There's that glorious scene in Mind of Evil where the Master's sitting in the Governor's chair and the Doctor gets brought in at gunpoint.
Mm.
And it's like, oh, how's the riot going? You know, now, look here. We haven't talked about Malcolm Clark.
We haven't, have we?
Do, 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 do.
And his music, in inverted commas. Actually, yeah. I rather like the music in the CW.
You're joking me.
I really rather like it.
It's a series of electronic bleeps and blops.
Yeah, but it's different. The only thing I didn't like was when they did that in episode one, when we first see Trenchard, it went for a really high pitch.
Yeah.
And in the BFI, that was like somebody sticking an ice pick through your head. But other than that, I rather like it. It's something different. And it makes this story stand out as well.
It's very interesting to Mark Ayres talk about Malcolm Hulk and Tristram Carey in one of the documentaries, because he says just this sort of period of experimentation is so much more interesting than sort of the usual Dudley Simpsons. Of course, now they're great, but shaking it up with something a little more risque.
Yeah, musically. I definitely agree. Dudley Simpson's music is absolutely fantastic, but when I think about how many episodes he scored, and I think how many of those actually stuck in my mind as soundtracks, not many of them do. There's a couple of really good ones. I mean, City of Death is gorgeous.
Excuse me, you and me were singing that. Dun, 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 dun.
Genesis of the Daleks, no. Evil of the Daleks.
There you go.
Yeah, there are a couple that really bang, but there are loads more which just sound very much like every other Doctor Who of the time, because with the best will in the world, you can't do the same job over and over and over again without getting the sound a bit repetitive. Even Murray Gold in the new series. Oh, yeah,
definitely.
Some of the tracks actually really stick out and they're brilliant, but a lot of the music is very much kind of, it's just the same kind of thing.
Dudley Simpson just, he sort of heightens the melodrama, adds suspense. He does, he punctuates Doctor Who brilliantly.
He does. He does a fantastic job. What's really weird is I watched, I did a marathon a while ago of my various TV shows. Not only Doctor Who, but the other things I had on DVD from the same period, and put them in at the same time to kind of, because I like seeing things in context. And you think, what else was on at the time and how did it look? Because those people saying, oh, you know, Doctor Who looks cheap in this era. And it's like, yeah, but so did everything else. Like in the late 1970s, inflation was screwing up the budgets for Doctor Who, but it was knackering the budget for everything else as well. So everything looked a bit cheap at that time.
I think if Graham Williams had a Pertwee budget, he would have found it luxurious.
But what's really weird is watching Doctor Who alongside Blake 7, because Dudley Simpson scored both of them up until 1980.
I find his Blake 7 music quite repetitive.
Yeah, and then he carries on with Blake 7 for two more years, but Doctor Who goes to Paddy Kingsland and the Radiophonic Workshop, and it kind of feels like a weird sort of time warp going on with Blake 7, because you know it's alongside Doctor Who, but it's the sound feels like a couple of years.
It feels old fashioned, doesn't it?
It hasn't moved along with everything else.
So. And I know the sort of electronic music has dated now as well.
Oh, bound to.
It all feels like Zelda and Mario Brothers. But...
Yeah, absolutely. But so the fact that Malcolm Clark is doing something different and experimental with this one makes it stand out, and I think it really works. I like it.
There's certain cues. I think one of the reasons I had difficulty with the Sea Devils initially was, one, that ugly location work, which was graded badly on the VHS release, and two, was that screaming music.
Yeah.
So I think I had to get over those two things in order to find lots that I enjoyed in this.
I think the VHS release, I think it, is it three, the first three episodes of this were brought back as NTSC copies from the US, so it's kind of duff quality to begin with.
Yeah, it was really bad.
Well,
it
looks been beautifully remastered, gorgeous and on sorted here. Out now. but yeah, it was a bit washed out.
Joe just made up the plan and managed to communicate silently to the doctor. Then he distracted the guard. She came in with her escapology. I mean, she's got some agency here. I think she's great.
No, yeah, she's really good.
It's so weird. I find that her scripts veer between her being a sort of a child who needs everything explained to her in very sort of minute detail to being just remarkably competent and effective. Like in The Mind of Evil, when she picks up that gun and she helps take down the riot, you know?
She is variable in terms of her competence. They do kind of lampshade it a bit in The Time Monster when she says, I know I'm exceedingly dim, but would you explain it to me?
Oh, my word, this submarine. There's a great story around that, isn't there?
Oh, the Ministry of Defence. How did you get this classified design? I didn't, I just made it up.
But isn't it... So, Michael Bryant says, apparently this admiral, retired admiral, watched this on the TV. This is why they came in. And was like, they've got top secret submarine plans, blah, blah, blah. And then when they actually watched the footage, they were like, it's nothing like it at all. The man's gone mad. I don't know if it's true, but it's a great anecdote. Yeah, this is really effective.
That is brilliant. Listening to the voices from the other sections in the submarine talking about how things are
fading out. And then you get the submarine alone in the water. It's everything you need.
It is. And that's that's something I think is really effective in various series. When something is going on elsewhere, instead you focus on the people stuck at the command area or whatever who can't do anything about it, and they're just hearing everything going wrong around them, and they're stuck impotently, unable to help. And I think that's really, really good, really dramatic.
It's like I said to you earlier, the things that scared me, it was adults in an anxious situation, you know, and usually in situations of peril. So something like, I mean, I've recently done a commentary on Resurrection of the Daleks, and I don't really like it very much for various reasons. But the sequences where, you know, where the Daleks just pour into the command centre and all those, they're all just terrified and they just get gunned down. Yeah. As a kid, that really scared me.
Yeah. Yeah, I can see you.
So that was very effective, that scene on the submarine. And then in a minute, you get the door melting as well.
Yes.
Which is marvellous. Because for a second, it looks very solid. And then it all just starts dripping. And then it just starts flopping, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And you think, fuck me, what are the sea devils doing? You know, what powers
do
they have?
That's how to do it. Unlike Warriors of the Deep, where they get a couple of quilts and mattresses as doors.
I'm not sure this would work, you know. Oh, I suppose she does punch him. Okay.
She does. But again, the whole knocking somebody out with a karate chop is a little bit of dramatic license.
Yeah, Barry Letts says on the commentary that the guards in Doctor Who have very weak necks.
Guards in Doctor Who, they're all useless.
My favourite one is, you know, Day of the Daleks. Oh, help! Oh! And the fella comes in and she smashes him over the head with a vase. So...
And that guy's still unconscious. He's going to need hospital treatment if he's been rendered unconscious for that long.
What's the end of episode 3? I can't remember now.
You can't remember the end of episode 3 of The Sea Devils? It's the absolutely iconic sea devil on the beach.
Oh, I wasn't sure if that was 3 or 4. Because, look at this model work of the submarine heading towards the seabed. I think that looks great.
It does look pretty good.
They're shooting it on film, that's why.
Model work on film always looks better than model work on video.
And we cut, the editing's good as well. You cut straight into the interior of the submarine with everyone sort of falling about and a bit of shaky sort of Star Trek camera work as well. Yeah. Because I wanted to talk about Trenchard, because he's departing the story soon, isn't he?
He will be next episode, yes.
And, is it in the next episode?
Yeah.
Okay, I'll wait for the moment then. Because I wanted to talk about the book.
Yes.
And how that differs in the book.
Yeah.
Oh, did you notice as well? He does this sort of twitch. When situations of peril, the camera, I think he does it now. It starts Yeah, there it is. Look. Yeah. But technically, all this sub stuff is unnecessary to the plot. What's it adding?
It's adding a way for the Doctor to get out of the Sea Devil thing when he goes down there later. Because he escapes on the submarine.
Oh, that's true. Well, that's a long game to get to the point.
It is, but it's, you know, if you're going to put something in like that, make it relevant. Do something else with it.
Are you sure that music's good? They just had Plinky Plonky run across the field music there.
It's not all fabulous, but some of it is really good. But I generally like the soundtrack for this because it is so different.
I feel very sorry for those people, you know, in the
Sea Devil. There's a clip that I knew that propped up in Resistance is Useless.
What's that?
That we shall use it to trap them all together, and he turns on that machine.
Oh, apparently this whole sequence, wasn't it? It was a massive abseiling sequence that they were going to do. Mm. And the reason why we basically cut from the top to the bottom is because the mist rolled in and you couldn't see a bloody thing. So they had to abandon the whole shoot and come back later and just film what they absolutely needed to tell the story. There's still an awful lot of location work there. Normally, in a 70s Doctor Who story, you get a ton in episode one, a bit in episode two, and then it sort of gets less and less as the story goes on.
There is a lot of location work.
Do you think that's something to do with Percy Peladon having none at all?
Oh, I'm sure that the budgeting was sorted out so that they could have more location footage. There's quite a bit in The Mutants as well.
That's true. Actually, there's a fair bit in Time...
There's monster. A fair bit in season 9 generally, location work.
I think, you know,
Percy Peladon's the only one that doesn't have any, I think.
They did have a bit more money at this point, but I think Barry Letts just kept saying, he kept asking, and they kept giving them a little more. But then they were raking it in from the colour licences, weren't they, at this point? Oh, crash zoom on Danger Minefield.
Danger Minefield.
So I'm assuming you like this cliffhanger.
Yeah.
Is that not a little undramatic, though, the way it just sort of got up there?
No.
I think it's more effective later when loads of them come out and he keeps cutting back in different directions to make it look as if there's a whole army of Sea Devils coming out of the water.
Yeah. I mean, Doctor Who directors are all masters, generally, of making it look like you've got more aliens than you actually have. Whether it's Daleks going round in circles through doors and things like that.
Do you know, I'd go as far, just to go back to where we started this episode, you know, talking about the length of the story, I'd go to say there's two things that are really smoothing out the length of this and sort of distracting us from the fact that we're running on the spot a little bit. One is the stylish direction, and the other is Malcolm Hulk's sort of layer of character work that he puts in.
Yeah, I would think that's a fair assessment. If you're going to write 2.5 hours worth of story, you need to make sure that you've got enough to keep it going. And the way this one, it doesn't introduce all the characters at the beginning and then stick with them for 6 episodes. You get new characters popping up, like the submarine crew. And so on throughout.
When
and
the Sea Walker Devils themselves. Is that episode 5?
Walker, I think, turns up in episode 5. Or it might be 4, I can't remember.
It really annoys me, you know, because I like a bit of rough cut of marmalade as well. It's very annoying. Well, look, should we head into episode 4?
I think we should head into episode 4.
Like you said, we've just had the iconic moment where the Sea Devil rises up out of the water. I'd imagine that's the sort of cliffhanger that was on everyone's lips, you know, the kids at school the next day.
Quite possibly. And it's a measure of the confidence in the production as well that the cliffhanger involves a close-up of the monster mask.
Yeah.
They're not in the distance. They're right up in the camera.
Regardless of what Uncle Brian might think, I think it's a good mask.
Oh, I think they're brilliant, yeah.
Well, let's go into 4 then, shall we?
Let's do that.